This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
After publishing The Population Bomb, written with his wife Anne, Paul R. Ehrlich has combined a lifetime of science, education, and public dialogue. Paul is the Bing Professor of Population Studies at Stanford University and President of Stanford Center for Conservation Biology. Now Dr. Ehrlich has published a new book with another giant of ecology and communication, Michael Charles Tobias. It's a long-running dialogue which ends up at the improbable station of optimism, I think. We'll have to ask Paul about that. It's called Hope on Earth, A Conversation. Paul Ehrlich, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be back.
So the title is about hope. It's almost a cursed word after the disappointment of some with the Obama campaign. Is hope a damaged word, and what should we hope for?
I think hope is a damaged word, but one still has to have hope. In other words, my great hope is that society will undergo an unexpected but not totally unusual transformation in which we begin to face our problems squarely and do something about them. There's no mystery about what's going on in the world. We know there are many too many people and that we're going to have to humanely reduce the population size over the next 50 to 75 years. We know that many people, not all, are consuming too much, and many people don't have enough to consume, and that we know how to fix as well. We've done it in the past. But the issue is, can we get going, or are we going to sort of be pushed under by the people who believe that you can grow forever with no consequences? And you know, if you look historically, there have been occasions when societies have changed dramatically quickly. The U.S. changed dramatically quickly in 1941 after the attack on Pearl Harbor. The whole Russian system, the Red Communist system, collapsed. The Soviet Union disappeared when it wasn't expected to. So societies can change rapidly, but boy, do we really need rapid change now.
In your new book, I was surprised to find discussions about butterflies and bugs as well, until I dug into your serious qualifications as an entomologist. I wonder, are we a little like insects in some ways?
Well, we certainly have the same kind of population dynamics, namely the same rules that govern how big an insect population, say, of insect pests is going to be, are the same basic rules that determine how big a population human beings who we're going to have. It's an issue of input and output. How many births and immigrants do you have versus how many deaths and emigrants do you have? So the basic numbers are the same. And of course, insects are, like us, dramatically affected by climate, and insects compete with us for food. And insects are ideal experimental systems to understand how the world works. And we know a lot about how the world works, and scientists have told the public a lot about how the world works. And right now, the public, at least in the United States, is paying very little attention.
Well, thinking of warring ants, what do you make of the resurrection of the Cold War with the United States and its allies against Russia and maybe China?
Well, I think it's a supremely stupid move. First of all, Russia's sphere of influence obviously ought to include the Ukraine and Sevastopol and places that were part of Russia before. We broke our promise to them that we wouldn't shove NATO at them. This is it's all got to do with an insane battle over oil and natural gas, two things that we should not be burning. As the head of the U.S. Bank pointed out, Iraq was over oil, Afghanistan's over oil and gas. We have CENTCOM, which is our military part of our empire, to try and control Central Asia. We have AFRICOM, which is designed to try and control the oil of Africa. And it's doubly insane because, of course, every scientist knows that we have to stop using oil and, as quickly as possible, also natural gas. Otherwise, we're going to see a collapse of civilization from the destruction of our life support systems as climate disruption gets worse and worse and worse. So, you know, fighting the Russians or Chinese over oil would be like if we were starving, fighting them over cyanide to eat. We've got to cooperate with the Russians and Chinese to try and solve the gigantic global problems, not just climate change, but the toxification of the entire planet, the increasing danger of huge epidemics, and, of course, the danger of resource wars, which could go nuclear, and which, for instance, if it went nuclear between India and Pakistan over their water problems having to do with climate change, it would destroy the United States and Russia as well. So we have great joint things that we've got to do with Russia and China. And the whole business over the Ukraine is fundamentally stupid foreign policy, largely on the part of the United States, although I'm not an admirer of Putin either.
It's strange. We talk about globalization as fine for the economy, as fine for corporations, but not a good idea when it comes to solving these common problems like what are we going to do about dumping in the atmosphere or how are we going to save the oceans from their problems?
No, absolutely. It's really nutty because the globalization, we should go back to the thinking of the founders of the United States when they had the great debates over the new Constitution, the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists. And their questions really were, how do we retain ourselves as separate states with separate, often religions and history sometimes fighting with each other, but how do we solve our common problems? And their common problems were things like, what if the British should come back? Our common problems are the states of the nation states of the world is how can we possibly solve climate disruption and toxics and so on. And many of the issues that our founding fathers faced trying to get the diverse colonies together are the same ones we need to face in order to get the diverse nation states together. We cannot solve these problems as individual nations. They must be solved jointly. And that means the nation state as the functional unit to do it has become obsolete and we've got to find ways to replace it.
You know, on a personal level, Paul Ehrlich, we may share one thing in common. My mother spoke and wrote classical Greek and Latin, and it shook me out of that idea, common at the time, that women were not smart enough to run corporations or governments. Do you think a greater role for women is part of that hope for the future?
Oh, I think it's absolutely central. If you want to solve the population problem, first of all, the problem of consumption can be solved very rapidly, but population can only be solved humanely in a relatively slow manner, and that means giving women totally equal rights and equal opportunities around the planet, and giving everybody who's sexually active access to modern contraception and backup abortion. Anybody who's against that is entirely unethical. All it does is kill women and ruin the world for our descendants. There are many, many people who are having more children than they want, and they don't have the capacity to limit them. So give women rights and the birth rate will go down. Give everybody access to contraception and abortion and the birth rate will go down. And we might actually save humanity. It's a great hope.
So, Paul, you're almost 82. Is this book, Hope on Earth, partly a summary of your life's thought?
Oh, no, I barely started. I mean, I'm not retired. I'm meeting with an administrator about my chairmanship tomorrow. In a couple hours. So, no, I'm just going, they're not going to get rid of me that easily.
I didn't think so. You know, it would be great if you could live to be 140 to see whether your predictions about the population you and Anne made back in the 1960s come true, or are they already coming true?
Well, I think they're already coming true, but I would love to see what it's like in 2030, but just briefly. But I'm going to be shot when I'm 106 by a jealous husband, so I don't worry about that.
Paul, it feels like, though, to be serious, that we are in a triage ward of issues that demand immediate attention, the species, the forests, the oceans, the climate. How can our listeners decide where to focus, what they should be working on?
Well, happily, virtually anything that will help society will help the whole problem. But you should go to mahb.stanford.edu. That's mahb.stanford.edu. Join the mob. It takes 2 minutes and costs nothing, and contribute to figuring out how we're going to do it. If your issue is women's rights, you'll help with the environment. If your issue is the environment, you'll help with women's rights and racism. It all ties together into one hideous mess, which is an advantage because as social animals, we can get together and solve these problems. The problem is that civil society isn't coordinated enough to get the job done, and that's what we need. We need better civil society looking forward and moving in the right direction, and you can help.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the famous author and professor Paul R. Ehrlich. We're talking about his new book, Hope on Earth. In past weeks, we received dire news about the planet. NASA scientists say the melting of glaciers in Antarctica is unstoppable, and so is sea level rise. It's hard work to hope in those times, don't you think?
Well, it's hard work to hope, but again, if we can transition away from the use of fossil fuels, we can limit the damage. And fortunately, sea level rise will be relatively slow. Much more dangerous is the impact of changing precipitation patterns and so on our agricultural system. Remember, we've already got over 800 million people starving on this planet. We've got 2 billion that are micronutrient malnourished. That is, they have problems functioning because they don't get the proper balance in their diet. And by the way, a paper that came out of the Stanford of the East, Harvard University, just demonstrated that as you put more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the nutritive value, the nutritional value of our crops declines, which is a very sad sign. When you change the patterns of precipitation, you make the world warmer, you have more and more difficulty getting enough food to feed everybody, which we don't do today. In other words, we need much more food to take care of the people who are already hungry, and people are talking about adding 2.5 billion people to the planet by 2050. That's many more people than were alive on the entire planet when I was born in 1932. That's not wise. And again, sea level rise will affect hundreds of millions of people, but the climate's effects on agriculture are likely to affect many billion people, and that's an even more serious problem.
So in this book, you're not afraid to light a few firecrackers, and I want to talk about the ultimate hope for Christians and Muslims as they want to find a better world after they die in heaven, and some extremists even hope the world will end, whatever that means. What can science offer as a rational view against that?
Well, science can tell you exactly, precisely what it's like after you're dead, and everybody knows it, and it's exactly like it was before you were born. We are in a period now that some people call the Endarkenment. The Enlightenment era has sort of come to an end, and we're moving from a world in which people made decisions on the basis of evidence, that was the Enlightenment, back to a position where people make decisions on the basis of faith. And as we have seen in many instances, faith is a miserable way to make decisions. If you have faith that somebody will save you if you drive your car 200 miles an hour into a wall, good luck. It's much better to work on evidence if people want to have a decent world. And I think everybody wants to have a decent world. It's sad that the education levels are so low that people believe the world, the universe, is actually created and run by a supernatural monster. There are 300 sextillion stars. That's more stars in the universe than there are grains of sand on all of Earth's beaches. More stars than grains of sand everywhere. And some people actually believe that the stars and all were created by a monster that still retains a deep interest in your personal sex life. It's an amazing thought. And yet we require our politicians to at least pretend they believe in stuff like that. So the answer is, you want to save the world, have any faith you want, but operate on evidence and do the things that will give your children and grandchildren a real chance to have a decent life. Because that's what we're stealing the world from. We're stealing the world from our descendants, and that's not ethical in any religion.
Well, you've worked on population perhaps more than anybody, and I'm wondering, is it possible religion is really an expression of our genetic need, deep in our genes, to reproduce ourselves as much as we can?
Well, there's no question that that's programmed into our DNA. But there's also no question we easily override it. In other words, I've surveyed many audiences now, over 14,000 women, and I've never found a single one who either had or planned to have more than 25 children, even though that's possible. Every society we know has always limited their reproduction. They do it in various ways, but it's still limited. Nobody has the maximum number of, no entire society has the maximum number of children. So it is certainly, all of us love children. We are designed by evolution, unlike chimpanzees, for instance, to love other people's children. We're the only big primate that actually will, for instance, wet nurse. In other words, no chimpanzee ever lets another chimpanzee nurse their child or hold it. because they're afraid it'll be killed. But human babies were designed to attract other people. If you bring a newborn baby into the studio, I guarantee you that the women there will start building nests and will switch, as will the men, to baby talk, to what's called mother ease. So they say, ooh, goo, 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 goo. We really relate to kids, and that's an important thing. I just wish people would start relating more to kids, not in terms of how many do I want, but what kind of world are the children I know going to live in, my children and my friends' children and my relatives' children, because they're all wonderful, and it's really easy to bond to other people's children. We were designed that way.
In 2013, you wrote and spoke widely about a very serious question: can a collapse of global civilization be avoided? Do you have any further thoughts on that now?
Well, actually, that's been out there. Of course, the scientific community reviewed the article and everything, and I'm sad to say that my colleagues all agreed with it, and there's been no major change. In other words, it has not. After all, when the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, announced its big thing about 3 months ago, the evening news on NBC gave more space to the story that a Dodger baseball pitcher was retiring than they did this from saying that the scientific community said we're on the road to a collapse of civilization. In other words, it's not news. As one of my colleagues said about the situation in Australia, where education is as bad as it is here, any society whose major values are mall crawling and sports is never going to have a decent education system. And you're not going to have people intelligent enough to know what's really news and what is trivial. And we have a terrible situation with the media. We're moving into an oligarchy, as you know. For instance, everybody's vote in the United States today is worth about a third of what it was when I was born, because it's a representative government. And as Madison noted in the 1790s, the big problem with increased population size is it wrecks any form of representative government or democracy, because your vote is deteriorating. And, of course, now, with the Supreme Court, you don't have any real vote anymore anyway. It's an oligarchy run by the corporations. You know, the best politicians money can buy.
Could you tell us about one of the settings of this book and your life, the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory? What is it and what goes on there?
Well, it's a laboratory that's run like a university. It's private in that sense. It has a board and charges people, and what goes on there is research on what goes on in the natural world. It's the best terrestrial field laboratory. It's high in the Rockies. My most interesting experiment is by a colleague of mine named John Hart, who has been heating some of the meadows about 2 degrees above normal for the last 23 years. And he's had plots that are heated and plots that are control plots that aren't heated. And the dramatic thing is, first of all, in his heated plots, the carbon has been disappearing from the soil, which is extremely frightening because, of course, it goes into the atmosphere and there's more carbon in the soil than there is now in the atmosphere. And if we dump the soil carbon into the atmosphere, it's going to make climate change much, much worse. But even more dramatically, he has no controls anymore because the plots he didn't heat have been following the ones that were heated. The natural warming of the climate has gotten onto his plots and is making the same things happen in them as happened 20 years ago when he put artificial heat on them. So the lab is a wonderful place. It's a great group of scientists doing important work. And it's been one of the great pleasures of my life to do my research out there virtually every summer.
Is there anything else on your mind that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, don't give up hope. Join the mob. Realize that things can change very, very rapidly. Realize that we have to treat not just our environment, but all our other fellow human beings the same way. We can differ greatly in all sorts of things. That's one of the great things about being a human being. And we settle them by discussion, and we need discussion. We need to talk about ethics. One of the things that you don't hear is it ethical for us not to do anything about climate disruption because we think that people are going to be richer in the future? Are they going to be richer in the future? Maybe they're going to be poorer. Then what should we do? We need a lot more discussion of sensible things and a lot less nonsense from the Tea Party and Rush Limbaugh and other assorted idiots.
We've been honored to have as our guest biologist, author, and Stanford professor Paul R. Ehrlich. And we've been talking about his new book, Hope on Earth, A Conversation with Michael Charles Tobias. Thank you for talking with us, Paul.
My great pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.